Just a little background for people who may not have done their homework and read the book that we're talking about this morning. Elaine Pagels was kind of there for the opening of the Nag Hammadi scrolls that were essentially a find of banned books. And so a lot of her writing and studying have been about what constitutes heresy in the early church and until those were found, we had a lot of writings about don't listen to the people who say this, don't listen to the people who say that, but we didn't have any of the texts from the people who were saying those things. So when they found these texts, they said, woo, these are the banned books of the early church. And so a lot of the quotes this morning and the readings are from some of those banned books. This first reading is a chapter of 1 Corinthians that she quotes that we almost never hear in church, but the short answer is a part of her argument that even Paul, who we consider really orthodox, had a bit of a maybe Gnostic streak to him. So from 1 Corinthians chapter 2, and so it was with me, brothers and sisters, when I came to you, I did not come with eloquence or human wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God, for I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness with great fear and trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. We do, however, speak a message of wisdom among the mature, but not the wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age who are coming to nothing. No, we declare God's wisdom a mystery that has been hidden and that God destined for our glory before time began. None of the rulers of this age understood it, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. However, as it is written, what no eye has seen, what no ear has heard, and what no human mind has conceived, the things God has prepared for those who love him, these are the things God has revealed to us by his Spirit. The Spirit searches all things, even the deep things of God. And a reading from Thunder Perfect Mind, one of those banned books. I am the first and the last. I am the one who is honored and the one scorned. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the incomparable silence and the voice of many sounds, the word in many forms. I am the utterance of my name. Do not cast anyone out or turn anyone away. I am the one who remains and the one who dissolves. I am she who exists in all fear and strength in trembling. I am she who cries out. I am cast forth on the face of the earth. I am the sister of my husband, and he is my offspring. But he is the one who gave birth to me. I am the incomprehensible silence and the thought often remembered. I am the one who has been hated everywhere and who has been loved everywhere. I am the one they call life, and you have called death. I am the one whose image is great in Egypt, and the one who has no image among the barbarians. I prepare the bread and my mind within. I am the knowing of my name.
Oh.
And now more from Thunder Perfect Mind. I am the thought that lives in the light. I live in everyone, and I delve into them all. I move in every creature. I am the invisible one in all beings. I am a voice speaking softly. I am the real voice, the voice from the invisible thought. It is a mystery. I cry out in everyone. I hid myself in everyone and revealed myself within them, and every mind seeking me longs for me. I am she who gradually brought forth everything. I am the image of the invisible spirit, the mother, the light, the virgin, the womb, and the voice. I put breath within all beings. As you can get, there's kind of a feminine quality to some of these readings that you don't necessarily find in the more orthodox scriptures. And now a reading from Elaine Pagels. What's found in the secret gospels and throughout the process of exploring the history of religion offers resources we're now beginning to appreciate. What also helped me was Heinz's insight and imagination, shaped by scientific inquiry, which often extends beyond personal suffering. Once, as noted before, when he saw me in anguish after we received our child's crushing diagnosis, he said something I often recall. Everyone's life has something like this in it. Angry, I snapped back, no, not this, not a child with a terminal illness. No, he said, not this, but something like this. Much later, I came to realize how much truth there is in what he said. Even now, writing about what's so deeply personal, I'm aware that anything I say can speak to you only as it resonates through what you have experienced yourself. Yet even within those limits, we may experience mutual recognition.
And that is our Southminster Reads book, Elaine Pagels' Why Religion, A Personal Story. And I'm going to invite our panelists to come up and take their seats. Janet Cruz, Dan Rasmussen, Susan Kozak, Joanne Wakeland, and Kathy Huddleston. And I have a question for each of them, and they know what the question is. So no surprises, no tricks. After that, they'll have a chance to a little bit of feedback as the answers to the questions, and then we'll have an opportunity for a couple of questions or comments from the congregation as well. I just want to say, Dan did an excellent job, thank you, about talking about the Nag Hammadi texts. That's a big deal with Elaine Pagels' career. She was the author of a number of books, including the Gnostic Gospels in 1979, Adam, Eve, and the Serpent, Sex and Politics in Early Christianity, The Origin of Satan, How Christians Demonize Jews, Pagans, and Heretics, Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. With Karen King, she wrote Reading Judas, The Gospel of Judas, and The Shaping of Christianity, Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation, and then her latest book came out in 2018, is Why Religion. And it's her personal story, but you'll see as you read the book and as the panelists will talk how her career really interweaves with it. It's not just something that's separate from her experience. And so I'm going to go ahead and begin with Janet. Janet, could you give a summary of Elaine Pagels' Why Religion, A Personal Story?
Okay. As John mentioned, Elaine Pagels is mostly known for her scholarly work in the Gnostic Gospels and early Christianity. She is a best-selling author, a MacArthur Genius Grant Award winner. She is a scholar and a full-time professor at Princeton University. Her most recent book is really a departure from her scholarly work, in that it is a personal account of what she experienced in her life in terms of loss and grief, and trying to reconcile those personal experiences with the lifetime spent studying early Christianity and the role of religion in our society and culture. For many, many years for her, they were parallel lives, her personal life filled with grief and rage, and her scholarly life, which was devoted to the purpose of religion. And the reconciliation of those two paths is what this book is about. Elaine Pagels was born in 1943 in Palo Alto, California, a place she considered very boring, very suburban, nothing going on. Her father was a scholar and a researcher at Stanford. He was a scientist, specifically studying botany. And in the home, although they would have said they were nominally Protestant, there was no religion. Her father felt that science would replace religion, and the religion was only for those who hadn't yet discovered the truth of science. So in that background, she had no religious upbringing or interest. In fact, there was disdain for the organized church. When she was close to 15 years old, one of her good friends invited her to San Francisco. Well, she thought that would be great fun, but didn't tell her father that the purpose of the trip was to hear Billy Graham speak at Candlestick Park. She knew that would not go over well, and she didn't expect to find it to be meaningful either. She just wanted to go to San Francisco. But it was a life-changing experience for her. She was immersed in that, thousands of people present at the presentation, and she actually stood up and went down and was born again, or I've never been to one of these, so I don't know exactly how this happens. But she had this experience at Candlestick Park that was life-changing for her. When she came back, she was filled with the power of that moment and how it brought people together in a sense of joy and community and purpose that she had found missing in her own life. So when she went back to Palo Alto, she confessed to her parents what had happened. They were a little upset, but she joined an evangelical church and she became very, very involved. Looking back on it now, she refers to it as a summer romance type of thing, where she was intensely engaged, but for a short period of time. What soured her on it was when her boyfriend and very, very intimate friend of hers was killed in an automobile accident. And when she went to her church and was sharing that, people were very profoundly sensitive to that loss and caring about her until they asked her, was he saved? Had he been born again? And she said, no, he was Jewish. And they looked at her in horror and said, oh no, that means he's gone to hell. She walked out and never went back. However, the power of religion stayed with her forever. And she spent the rest of her life trying to discover what is the power of the New Testament that brings people to it in their time of despair and times of great joy, and how do they find such meaning in it for their own lives. When she graduated from high school, she couldn't get out of Palo Alto fast enough. She went to New York City, and she had to choose between studying dance. I think it was with Martha Graham. She must have been, well, when you see the pictures of her, she's quite the dancer physique, or studying religion at Harvard. She thought that the life of the dancer required too much dieting and discipline. She went to Harvard instead and became a well-known scholar. While at Harvard, she discovered the secret gospels. We now know them as the Gnostic gospels, and they're no longer such secrets. If you come to Jesus Seminar, we look at them frequently. She spent her life work, she found great meaning in the Gnostic Gospels and has written about them widely. She married Heinz Pagels. He was, in his own right, a very well-known theoretical physicist from Rockefeller University. I know nothing about the field of physics. I had never heard of him, but we all Googled him when we read the book, and he was very highly regarded in his field. They struggled to have family, so when their child Mark was born, it was a cause for great, great celebration for them. Shortly after his birth, however, they discovered that he had a congenitive heart problem. He had open heart surgery, and they thought that it was corrected and that he would be fine. At the age of two, however, he started having some physical difficulties, and they took him in and discovered that he had pulmonary hypertension, which is, I guess, a complication that can come from this heart condition. and she was told that that was invariably terminal. There was no cure, no help. And after the shock of that, she said, well, how long might he have? And they said, could be a couple months, could be a couple years, but this is what you need to expect. He actually lived for 4 years after that fatal diagnosis, but it was a very difficult, as you can imagine, time trying to have, you know, nurture your child, have him live a normal life, knowing that this would be the outcome. And indeed, at the age of 6, their son Mark died. Before he died, they adopted a little girl because they couldn't have more children. 18 months after Mark died, they were in Colorado, and Hines, her husband, was hiking in the mountains and suffered a fall and was killed instantly. She was filled with rage and grief. It was more than... I'm almost starting to cry, remembering how she describes how horrible that was. She was still recovering from the loss of her son, and now she had to face the loss of her husband in this climbing accident. And in the meantime, they had adopted a second child who was just months old. After the death of her husband, she went through what she calls very dark period, absolutely filled with rage. And unlike many who find solace in their religion during these times of grief, she found nothing but anger in the church, in what the teachings of the church were. She said primarily one of the things is people were always telling her God's plan, God's will, and she just could not accept that it would be any God's will that her son Mark and her husband would be taken from the world in such a way. She also found that people tended to think this must be punishment for something because good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. They don't say that outright, but intrinsic in the belief is that. And then there's the guilt. She said, we're made to believe that you're guilty for things when they happen. There always might be something that you could have done to prevent it. She, in her very scholarly way, traces that back to Adam and Eve and how if we had only been good, we would have stayed in the Garden of Eden. And she said, it's just cultural, and part of religion teaches that. So she found no solace whatsoever in what she had been brought up to believe was religion. And she said, there is no place for rage in the Christian church. They don't know how to handle it. There's no place for your tremendous grief. People don't want to talk about the loss of a child. They will say, that's too bad, and change the subject. So she was very, very suffered. It was not till 30 years later that she was actually able to write this book. So she basically compartmentalized her life. She was a single mother, 2 very small children, had to move out of New York because she couldn't afford to live in New York on her single salary with 2 small children. Plus, she couldn't be traveling to Princeton and back without the help of a husband to help take care of the kids. These are very common problems people deal with. So she sold their home in New York City and moved to Princeton, hired a nanny, went back to work, and at that time, she also got a MacArthur grant, so she had some kind of not such intensive time of working, which was helpful to her during this time of transition. But she immersed herself in her scholarly work and found comfort in that. She's tremendously successful and somehow began to heal. And don't want to steal the thunder of the people that are going to speak after me, but she does answer the question of why religion. Why religion for her is that she went back to the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas, the one that, in fact, our opening reflection is basically what she found, that there is a divine source of light in each of us. And if we can take the time to discover that for ourselves and reach out and discover that light in others, there is a humanity that binds us together that does provide comfort in our greatest time of sorrow. It's a very powerful message. When asked why she wrote the book, she said, it took me 30 years to reconcile my own religion and faith and understanding of God with my scholarly work. But I think she feels that now, at the age of 76, she's been able to do that. And she wrote the book not as a catharsis, but as a gift to all of us, for when we are in time of great sorrow and need, we can find the religion that will help us recover. Good book.
All right, thank you, Janet. With that description of her own personal story and the book, as well as the texts themselves, this is a four-minute clip of an interview that she had at a bookstore about her book and her experience.
How did the Gnostic Gospels, how did your study of ancient texts come to inform your own understanding of suffering and your own understanding of how to make sense out of all of this?
Well, making sense is something I didn't aspire to. It was more like survival. But I did feel that the Gospel of Thomas had spoken to something very deeply, because it talks about how all people are created in the image of God. It talked about the connections between all human beings and their source, the divine source. And it teaches that you can find your way back to the divine source because you have access to that within yourself, whether you know it or not. And that's why the bishops didn't like these texts, because they suggested you could get to the divine source, whatever that, however you see that, without a church, without a bishop, without Jesus, for that matter, because you had access just deep within. And I did feel that I had in what was given in those sources, a sort of sense of a path. You know, where the Gospel of Thomas says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. And I didn't know if I could survive what happened. I didn't really want to for some time. But I needed to for those children and for my husband, because he wouldn't have left them. So they suggested a way, you know. And later I went to the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. Had to leave New York because I couldn't live there, you know, and have the children in New York. So, and I started to write and think about my work again, which became another path, along with friendship. That was very important.
There are so many questions that I want to ask you. I'll give the audience the opportunity, but I want to ask you just two more. People who know that I know you, Elaine, always ask me, what does Elaine believe?
That's a question I ask myself.
What does Elaine believe? And do you believe, this is maybe an unfair question, but do you believe in God? And how do you think about belief?
But as you know, Eric, we've had a few discussions. I think belief is partly overrated. You know, people think that the question about religion is, do you believe in this or that? Because Christianity in the 4th century was defined as a set of beliefs. But there was a Christian movement for 300 years before that, and it was constituted of people who shared the same values, who had a certain faith, who worshiped together, who prayed together. And that, to me, was deeper, because there were times when I didn't feel I could believe in anything particularly. But I was sustained by the community of people. And so I feel that that's more important. So many traditions, like Judaism, is not primarily about what you believe, or maybe some people feel it is, but it's about, do you practice? Are you Orthodox? To what degree do you practice? To what degree do you participate in holy days or dietary laws or not? It's a matter of how you live. And I really felt that these texts are about that, and about how we deeply care about each other. I mean, the center of the Christian message, which of course comes from its Jewish sources, is about relationship between people and how we treat each other. That's the fundamental theme of these sources. So that, to me, is the most important, the way we connect with each other.
Just before I go to the next question, I was inspired by her book, Gospel of Thomas, Beyond Belief. And when I remember when I was first here, wrote an article about beliefless Christianity that invited a few protesters. But it was really Elaine's insights on regarding that. It's not about just believing stuff. Dan is next. Dan, what was the takeaway from this book for you?
Well, one takeaway was that I think Elaine would approve of how we do worship here, where we read from lots of different sources, because I think what she found in her journey was the more voices she had to draw from, the better. I mean, she could find comfort in different traditions, different religions, different writings that she had access to. I grew up in a kind of Christianity should be simple environment, where it was like you just need to understand these three basic things and you're saved and you're done, and go bring in the next person. And I was always looking for that, you know, maturing in the faith. What happens after that? And I think these wisdom writings and so forth are part of that. And I think it's she has great arguments against keeping your Christianity too simple, and imagining that it's all contained in one book. And I think I haven't gone through the kind of pain she went through, so, you know, I can't relate too well, but I know I wouldn't relate well to people who said, well, all the answers you need are right here in the Bible. Just, you know, just rely on the faith you were raised with, and that's it. And I think she would reject that, and I found it very, very educational and insightful. And just to pick up on one little thing Janet said, I keep thinking of different meanings for the title. I mean, she doesn't ever really kind of give a clear meaning of why I titled this book, Why Religion? But in one sense, one of the meanings was that was sort of the reaction she got from the people who raised her in Palo Alto when she said she wanted to go off to Harvard and study religion. I mean, that was, she did not come from a very religious background, so she left home and went to find her own journey, and why religion was kind of the question that people asked her as she went.
Well, let's move to that question further. Why religion? That's the title of her book, Sue. Did she answer the question for you, or how would you answer the question?
Well, in the book club discussion group that we had for First Tuesday, we had answers that range from no, she doesn't answer the question. Yes, she answers it for herself. And somewhere in between, yes, she answers it for herself, and yes, she answers it for everyone, and then everywhere in between. So for myself, I would say that she answers the question, why religion? You know, most simply, she says it's because we suffer and need help. And her examples from her life is how religion, you know, helped her through that. I think also in reading her story, what struck me was the act of being an academic, the act of spending her whole life studying scriptures. I think that was healing for her. And I think what she maybe doesn't articulate, but what I kind of got out of that is, in that sense, she was searching for meaning. And so she was a co-creator in finding the meaning. So the scriptures were there, and she found answers in it. But I think it's just as important to invest yourself in that study, and through that process, answers arise. Also, I was very struck with, I felt for her that religion was relational, that the people that were around her that did help her were extremely helpful to her. And for her, that was part of religion. She had examples of people who didn't help her, but she also had many wonderful examples of people who were in more of the contemplative, meditative, Buddhist traditions, monks, and she found great solace in having relationships with those people. And I think that was the mystery. She was able to experience mystery in connections with others who also experience mystery. Thinking for me is, why religion? I thought, well, what about when we're not in extreme suffering? What if we're comfortable in many times in our life. Does religion have any part to play then? And so I was wondering, well, did Elaine answer that question? And I'm not sure that she did for me. So I was thinking about it and relating it to her book, and I came up with the idea of empathy, sympathy, and compassion. And empathy is when you feel others' pain, and sympathy is when you feel others' pain and you understand, whatever that means. And then compassion is when you feel others' pain, you understand, and then you do something about it. You do something to reduce the suffering that you know is happening in someone else's life. And I think for me that religion can play a role there. And I think that other parts of the scriptures that maybe she doesn't highlight, but that do exist, have been important to me and in my faith journey and here at Southminster.
All right, thank you, Sue. Joanne, the death of Elaine's son and the death of her husband are key events in her life. Did her personal story and response to grief resonate with you?
Well, I guess as the quote in the book said, everybody experiences something like this. This kind of story would resonate with anyone. I have to say, though, that my life has been so, I always feel like I've lived a charmed life. Everything has been easy. I have a large family, and everybody in the family lives to, with a couple of exceptions, lives to old age and dies naturally, and people kind of say, well, yeah, it was her time, and move on. So it is hard for me to feel with her on the level that she feels. The two, she has lots of reactions to her grief. Some of them, I mean, she goes from all the usual things, shock, anger, despair, denial, of course, all the way to overwhelming guilt, major holes in her memory. I mean, she forgets, she doesn't recognize somebody who meets her in Texas who has lived in her house for months. And she just like doesn't remember seeing them before. And she has physical symptoms ranging from boils all over her body to recurring bouts of pneumonia that she says that felt like coming from suppressing her grief and possibly even breathing wrong, it seems like she was saying. These are things I have no experience with, except I guess I could say, and the rage, of course, the rage. I have very little experience with rage. Guilt is the one that I've experienced strongly. And I would say the one time, I don't think of myself as a very spiritual person either. And the one time when I suppose what came from within me or whatever, was an experience of guilt when I was just driving myself crazy with guilt. So we are all good at guilt. You know, she would say perhaps, as Janet said, that guilt is part of our culture, but she also says that guilt is a way that we as people proclaim our control over things that we can't control. By feeling guilty, we take on things that are really not our fault, but it's a way of claiming that we have some control over life when we really don't. So, you know, that I could resonate with. Other people will have much stronger stories of the kinds of death or the kinds of grief that she talks about. I wonder how I would have gotten through her kinds of experiences. I feel, in a sense, like I was her rather unfeeling, suburban parents, because that's the kind of background I came from, but never to the degree that she's talking about here. Or like her mother-in-law, who, in order to deal with her own guilt, had to distance her grief, had to distance herself from her. It talks in the book a lot about how people deal differently with grief, and people do deal differently with grief. And I read the book thinking, could I have survived what she went through? And I'm not at all clear that I could. So.
Thanks, Joanne. Our last question is for Kathy. Kathy, why was this book chosen for Southminster Reads, and how might it connect with members at Southminster?
Well, I think if you're still here, and you are, I think the answers to that are pretty obvious. But for me, when we chose the book, the Adult Education Committee, every year we try to choose a book that we think would be interesting and relevant to the community. If we all read it and we all kind of had it in our background, our original thought was, let's try to have a shared sense of a community sense of maybe some texts that we can draw on as a community that have meaning. And we picked this one because I think it really hits us as a community at two different levels. We have come through reflecting on a lot of the theology that she has studied her whole life. You know, we hear in church about the Gospel of Thomas and some of these Gnostic Gospels, and we have the Jesus Seminar here every year. So she is a Christian scholar who's very much in the progressive Christianity tradition. So I think that just picking something by her as a very noted author in that tradition and a woman is something that we thought as a committee that would be a good choice. But also, I think the personal nature of it, the fact that she does not refer to this as a memoir. She says it's not really a memoir. It's her processing her life experience with a focus on the religious texts that she immersed herself in and how those supported her personal experience. And I think it just provides another dialogue, another perspective for us to consider in terms of how we use our faith and how we use the progressive Christian texts. And I mean, there were just many things as I was reading the book that I thought, oh yeah, we will definitely appreciate this. You know, she talks about evil and how do you think about good and evil. And so I think it's the two things. It's the fact that it's not just a memoir about grief, which I think I know there are many in the congregation who have experienced this directly. The loss of a husband, the loss of a wife, the loss of a child, you know, miscarriages, illness, so many struggles that have touched our community, where we want to know how can we be a loving community, how can we reach out and support each other through these very difficult experiences. But also then, in our heads, what kinds of Christian practices or even non-Christian practices can help, and what kind of friendship can help. So, you know, I'm really happy that we read this book as a community, and if you haven't had a chance, it's in the library, there's lots of copies, and it's pretty easy to read. It's also not, you know, it's not super long, and it's really engaging. So I just recommend it.
The panel, Kathy, and all of the panel, thank you. That was excellent. It's 5 minutes after 11, although you won't know about it by seeing no clock behind there, so I guess that's divine permission. No, we've got two important things to do. One is take the offering and then give you a benediction. But if you give us 5 more minutes, if there is a question, we do want to take that, or a comment that anybody would just like to ask the panel about the book. Or if any of the panel members want to have another 10 seconds to
We've been through a lot in our family and myself personally. The one thing that I kept waiting for is her asking, what are the lessons? What are the lessons when this person dies, when you, there are serious things that happen to you? Because just owning the negativity and moving on is one thing, but I personally think that when things happen like this, there's ways for us to grow. And we need to not only ask why, but what am I supposed to learn from this? How can I grow from this? And so that was just a piece that I wanted to add.
All right, great. That's a good question. Anybody want to just take that 15, 20-second response? What was the, did she talk about a lesson at all, or?
One of the things she says is that people said to her, you can grow from this, or, you know, these kinds of things. And it made her furious. Yes. Exactly. She said, this is schadenfreude. They're just celebrating that they didn't go through this. So she said quite, I don't remember exactly the words, but she said, we can't get, we can't take a lesson, or we can't get a lesson from this, or something like that, but we can make a lesson from this. She said, so, you know, some people who would say, okay, I think she had an example in there of somebody who had lost somebody close, perhaps this was in the Holocaust, I don't remember now, and then threw herself into trying to save others. Said, I'm not getting this lesson. This lesson isn't coming from me. I am seizing this lesson.
Spirit of life, spirit who hovers over the water, spirit who energizes and re-energizes and resurrects, we thank you for the gift of Elaine Pagels and for her sharing her story with this congregation and for our panelists who deeply engaged with it, touching on the important parts of life. And we thank you for the opportunity to seize the lesson. In Christ we pray. Amen.